It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth. Spring is here and the birds are on their way. The birders have even showed up on the Homer Spit. And in a few weeks now, there'll be a big shorebird festival starting in Homer, the Kachemak Bay Shorebird Festival. Copper River Delta Shorebird Festival is coming up in Cordova, and the Stikeen River Shorebird Festival is happening. Why all the festivals? Well, because of these amazing clouds of shorebirds that descend on Alaska at this time of year and are sort of the opening gun for summer in coastal communities. And we've got some great guests to talk about birding and shorebirds, and we hope to hear from you. If you have questions or some experiences with birding that you want to share, to get on the show with us, you just call 550-8433. Outside Anchorage is 888-353-5752, and Facebook is Outdoor Explorer. In the studio with me right now is Nils Warnock, who's Executive Director of Audubon Alaska, and he's going to be with us for the hour. Thanks for being with us, Nils.
Thank you.
And on the phone is Monty Davis with the Homer Chamber of Commerce, where the Kachemak Bay Shorebird Festival will be getting underway on May 9th, about 3 weeks away. Time to make your plans, time to set up your hotel rooms and everything else for that great event. Thanks for being with us, Monty.
It's my pleasure, Charles. Thanks for having me.
And Monty, you were saying that you've got some birders who are already on scene and that you're pretty safe to have a large number of shorebirds on May 9th when the festival actually begins.
Yeah, we are already seeing, we've seen several pairs of swans, which is, I just love that harbinger of spring, that have come through already. And I noticed, I didn't get a chance to stop this morning, but my wife actually works out on the spit, and I noticed a flock of, I don't know what they were. I really didn't get a chance to stop, but it was the first, you know, as you said, actually cloud of shorebirds that I've actually seen so far this spring. And there are, as you said, birders are already at the viewing station. This morning on our drive out there at 7:30, there were four cars parked alongside one of the viewing stations, spotting scopes set up. So, yeah, people are already here and excited.
So you don't even need to go beyond Homer Spit for some good views of these birds.
No, one of the things that we love about in Homer, there, we know of at least 25 different species of birds that you can see right from the road. It doesn't require a boat, doesn't require anything better than a good pair of binoculars or a spotting scope, and in all honesty, in a lot of cases, not even that.
Mm-hmm. Nils Warnock, you're director of Alaska Audubon, but you're also a scientist, and you spend a lot of time studying shorebirds. It's a kind of a remarkable phenomenon with these enormous flocks of birds coming all at once. Why does this happen? Why is this a phenomenon that we see?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the big driver for these guys is you think of this migration window that they have. So a lot of these birds, like our western sandpipers, which is the most abundant shorebird species along this flyway, what we call the Pacific Flyway, there's maybe 4 million birds. And these birds will winter anywhere from South America all the way up to about San Francisco Bay. And if you think about the weather up here, and all we have to do is look out our window here in Anchorage, and we see a lot of snow and ice still. So these birds, if they get here too early, they're going to hit snow and ice, and they'll risk starving to death, basically. If they show up on their breeding grounds on the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta or up on the North Slope, they'll starve to death. So they've got to time it just right. But if they show up too late, their young hatch too late, and then they're on the tundra, because most of these shorebirds are, not all of them, but a lot of them are tundra breeders, and they'll grow up. Later, they'll miss the big peak of the insect hatch, et cetera. Mm. And so they don't have as high survival rates as the ones that show up just in time. So they're playing this big dance, basically, of with the weather, et cetera. You can't get up too early. You can't get up too late. And it's very different in the fall. Mm-hmm. They have a longer migration period.
So they wouldn't be as grouped up the same way in the fall.
So we don't see them grouped up. And the other thing that happens is the weather can really stack them up. We call it stacking them up. Some years you can go to a site and you'll see hundreds of thousands of birds, and then other years you'll see relatively few. And usually that kind of variation is dictated by weather that either puts them down or it's really favorable and they keep on mm-hmm. going.
Now, if folks are wondering what we're talking about in terms of these numbers of birds and clouds of birds, we've got some great photos on our website at alaskapublic.org. Just look for Spring Bird Festivals. And these are pictures taken by a guest we're going to have on later, Milo Burcham, from the Copper River Delta Shorebird Festival. But what they essentially show is just these extraordinary groups of birds that almost look like a solid mass of birds. And so I guess if you're a birder, these aren't particularly hard to find or hard to see, right? What you're looking at is just an amazing sort of amount of life, of avian life.
Yeah, I mean, the Copper's a little different in that that's a really big area. Mm-hmm. If you've been there, I know you have. But for folks who haven't, the Delta is actually probably 100 kilometers long, so 60 miles long. And the birds, when they start arriving in the spring, and we've showed this with some radio telemetry birds, they'll show up down at the south end of the Delta, and they move up. And later in the migration, they'll end up I'm spacing on the name of the basin they all show. I want to say Bowerman Basin, but I don't think that's it. Anyways, there can be lots of numbers, and copper will get almost the entire world's population of westerns in the spring. So anywhere, wow, 3 to 4 million birds, but they can be way out on the mud flats, way mm-hmm. out on the deltas that are hard to get to. But when they really stack in there, you can see a lot of birds there.
Mm-hmm. Now, the birds we're talking about are these, many non-birders in the audience, believably, there are some out there.
Yeah.
But we're talking about these little guys with long, pointy beaks and long legs primarily, and they're walking along the beach, essentially pulling something out of the mud, out of the gravel to eat, right?
Yeah. Yeah, they're... The shorebirds in general, and the ones that we see here, the common ones are things... Dunlin, Western sandpipers, they weigh maybe 30 grams, which isn't very much. I forget mm-hmm. what that is in pound. Certainly a lot less than a pound.
A few ounces.
Yeah, a few ounces. And they're eating a lot of invertebrates, so little worms. They're eating small clams. And they're pretty amazing what they can do. There's been studies. There's one bird, a red knot, that shows up in Homer. It shows up in the Copper. It's one of our not real common shorebirds up here. They actually have little pressure sensors in their bill that they can, when they touch the substrate, the mud, they can actually form a little 3D picture of what's underneath in the mud, and they can find, they tend to eat hard clams, but they can actually form this little 3D picture.
Oh my gosh.
From these pressure sensors in their bill. It's pretty amazing.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
Wow.
Isn't that cool?
The red knot is our actual, every single year at the Kachemak Bay Festival, we actually pick a bird of the year, and the red knot is our featured bird this year. So thank you for that piece of information. I had never heard that before.
Yeah, now you have the ultimate fun fact to spread for the festival.
Yeah.
It's Outdoor Explorer, and we're talking about the Spring Bird Festivals, the Shorebird Festivals happening in Homer and in Cordova. I'm not going to talk about Wrangell, that's too far away, but anybody in Anchorage could get down to Homer or Cordova for these festivals, and it's just a great opportunity to get down to the water and see these amazing birds, and you don't have to be an expert bird watcher to see them. Monty, how many people come down for your festival typically, and what kinds of events do you have planned for them?
Well, we have over 80 events, and it's everything from learning how to photograph them. We have lots of actual bird walks. We have tours put on by some of our local charter operators. We have a few operators down here who really specialize in birds. You know, Homer's well known for its halibut fishing, but we actually have two or three different operators that I can think of who really never go halibut fishing. They spend all of their time doing birding, and this is their time to shine. So they do, over the course of those 4 days of the festival, a lot of them do two a day where they take people out and give them the opportunity to see birds that you don't necessarily get to see from shore. So we're excited about that. We have a wonderful junior birders program that's an opportunity for adults to go with their kids and actually watch and help their kids learn how to bird, the ethics of birding. That's a fabulous program that has grown and grown through the years. Like I say, it's actually over 80 events through the course of the 4 days of the festival. We have a wonderful keynote speaker this year, Jeff Gordon, who is the president of the American Birding Association, will be our keynote speaker. That's on Saturday evening. Generally around 400 people or so fill up our Mariner Theater at the high school and listen to a wonderful talk given by somebody, and we're very excited to host Jeff this year. I could go on and on. There's a number of events that are actually included with the, it's a $15 registration fee.
$15?
Yeah, $15, wow. And then $5 per extra person in your family. So even for a couple, it's only $20 to register, and a number of the events are actually included in that registration.
And I guess as a community, you're getting visitors into the community and filling up the hotels and the restaurants, and so you're willing to, I guess, probably not make it back on your registration fee, which sounds kind of nominal.
Yeah, you know, we're actually... this year, for the first time, we're finally starting to see the effects of the recession. There's been a couple of grants that we've gotten in the past that we're not seeing this year. So we're actually really trying to encourage our locals. So many of the locals here in Homer love the festival, but they've gotten so used to these events that are free and included, you know, with the cost of registration, that they haven't registered. So we started a bit of a campaign here in town just to remind our locals that they will need to support this thing financially going forward, at least for a couple years, maybe until the economy does rebound, or, you know, we see that it really has rebounded. But at this point, not in financial straits, but, you know, just a little concerned about the sustainability should things continue on the way they are. So, you know, we want to continue having as many things as possible that are included with the registration. And that's what we're trying to do is make this, recognizing that this is an educational opportunity. And again, Nils will, I'm sure, appreciate this. Our theme this year is Baja to Beaufort, Every Wing Beat Counts. And we're trying to get across to folks that, you know, yes, we see and enjoy these birds here, but we need to be thinking as a planet. You know, how are these birds affected all the way up and down their flyway? We're just one stop on the way. Every stop is critical.
Yeah.
And so we're just trying to, you know, that's why we say the educational part of this is as important to us as filling our B&Bs. And I would, you know, I'm a chamber of commerce, so of course that's important, you know, for us to recognize that we are bringing money into the community and giving people the opportunity, we think, the opportunity to come and share our community with us.
Yeah.
So,
well, let me ask one more thing about that. Is there... if I am a person who knows absolutely nothing about birds, or maybe has never even been to Homer, is the festival provide an opportunity for me to sort of go out and learn how to do it? I mean,
It certainly does. We have beginning birder talks, and those are included with the registration, and they happen every single day, and they happen early enough in the day that you could take, you know, advantage of it on Friday and be out by Friday afternoon taking advantage of the things that you've just learned, you know, at 10 o'clock that morning.
Oh, neat.
Yeah, and those beginning talks are, we do them every single year, recognizing, hopefully, you know, that we're growing the birder world.
Great.
There's lots of things like that.
So the information is all on their website down there at the Kachemak Bay Shorebird Festival, and you can Google that, or you can also find it linked on our site at alaskapublic.org. And we welcome your calls and comments about our topic today on Outdoor Explorer. If you would like to call in and you're in the Anchorage Bowl, the number is 550-8433. Outside Anchorage, it's 888-353-5752. Facebook's a great way to get on the air too, Outdoor Explorer. And I'm just interested in folks who have been to one of these festivals. Did you enjoy it? What was cool about it? Why would you want to go for a festival rather than just going on your own? You know, what made it worthwhile? In the studio with me is Nils Warnock, who is the executive director of Audubon Alaska. What is the range of birds you would be looking at in Kachemak Bay at this time of year? Are some of the birds that people really love seeing in Kachemak Bay are the alcids, such as the puffins and the auklets and things like that. They're not here yet, right? They're still out at sea, or are they showing up yet?
No, you should be able to go out and see some of those. The Kittlitz's murrelet, marble murrelet. Those are some of the birds people will be chasing. You know, red-faced cormorant. I'm not quite sure they'll be there yet, but I think you have a pretty good shot at things like red-faced cormorant. And then with the shorebirds, you never know. Last year was an exciting year at the festival. We had, these are rare shorebirds, but birds that showed up included the bar-tailed godwit. That's a bird I did a lot of research on. They'll fly from Alaska nonstop to New Zealand.
Wow.
And then
how the heck do they do that?
They amazing things. They do a lot of flapping, and they're over eight days that it takes them to do it.
So they never land?
They never land. And
that's incredible.
They double their body mass in fat. So that's their fuel. Mm-hmm. Like, think of your car. They fuel up in fat, and they'll double their body mass. They restructure their entire organ system. Just before they leave, they'll actually dump half of their stomach, because that's just dead weight. They're not using their stomach in flight.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll take off, and they use up that fat, and bang, if the winds are right and everything, they'll come down to where they started in some estuary in New Zealand or Eastern Australia. So that was one
Amazing.
Of the birds
that is just a mind blower. If you think an engineer trying to find a fuel that would carry you that far, they'd never be able to do it. Yeah.
Well, after we did that, we had scientists at MIT looking at it, because mm-hmm. they were fascinated by how these birds are actually physically
and
able to
do it. What was that species again?
The bar-tailed godwit.
So that's an unusual one, or rare.
That's a big shorebird. They breed on the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta.
Uh-huh.
And then other birds, we had a bristle-dyed curlew showed up. That got the birders very excited. That's a bird that breeds. It's a larger shorebird, breeds up on the Seward Peninsula and in the northern part of the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. There's probably only 10,000 birds in the world. And they typically fly out into the Pacific Islands, anywhere from the Hawaiian Islands down into the Marshalls, and they'll winter out there and fly back.
So when we see these guys in Homer, they are restoring their energy supplies from a really, really long flight.
And something Monty said, you know, we are just one of the pieces in the chain in a place like Homer or over at the Copper and in Boundary Bay. That's the one I couldn't remember.
Mm-hmm.
It is part of the chain, and these birds are really sensitive to disturbance, because they're coming in, and we know from our radio work that the average Western that stops at either on the Copper or Kachemak, it's even a little less, they're only here for 2 days on average.
Mm-hmm.
And so they still have another 1,000 to 2,000 kilometers, so 600 to 1,200 miles to go to the breeding ground. So they're really stopping to top up the engine, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And they need to get up there with enough fuel, especially the females. They still have to produce then 4 eggs, and they sit on those eggs and mm-hmm. et cetera. So they've got to have enough fuel to do the migration, finish it, and then be in good enough shape to breed. So really sensitive to disturbance. That's one of the things I always, you know, push that point.
Be sensitive as a birder.
Yeah, give them distance.
Don't disturb them. Mm-hmm.
Especially the photographers, they get pretty excited about mm-hmm. getting those killer shots, like you've seen. We see Milo's shots and things. I always feel like the
big lenses.
The parent, now be careful. Don't push them too much, you know, because they're working hard.
Now, Monty, tell me about just sort of some of the travel details for folks who want to come down to Homer. I'm assuming that it's still kind of wintertime rates and you could get a pretty good deal on a room.
Yeah, and actually almost every one of our hotels or motels has a special for that weekend. They do their very best to try to make it as affordable as possible. You know, so almost any of the B&Bs, certainly they can go on our homeralaska.org, the Chamber of Commerce's website, and look under accommodations, and there's hot links there to any number of places. But as I say, the neat thing about it is almost everybody that I can think of is offering some kind of a festival rate, a festival weekend price. The restaurants usually have some specials going on. So, you know, again, while we love the idea of bringing dollars into the economy, we want to share this with people. That's the biggest reason that they do this festival is, mm-hmm. You know, first of all, it is that wonderful harbinger of spring that, you know, it's as in a longtime Alaskan, that was something I always looked forward to. It told me that winter is definitely behind us at that point. And so that's always really fun. We just love to share the bounty that is Kachemak Bay with the rest of Alaska and the world. We have folks from New Zealand coming this year. They've already registered. Somebody from Mexico has already registered. So we have some very far-flung people who are coming to the festival this year. Last year, I was absolutely astounded looking out in our parking lot on the days when folks who hadn't registered online were stopping by the chamber. I mean, I saw license plates from Michigan, Alabama. I'm trying to remember, but I mean, it was very impressive to look out there and see six or seven different states here in May. So it's fairly obvious they came for the birding.
Yeah, and I'm guessing that anybody you see in the street or in the restaurant has got a common interest. So if you're a birder who wants to meet other birders, it's a place to be.
Yeah, and always willing to share information if at all possible. Mm-hmm. That's the, you know. So and luckily we don't have a lot of roads down here, so you know if there's no big secret spots, you know.
It's hard to get lost, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. Well, thanks so much for being with us, Monty. That's Monty Davis of the Homer Chamber of Commerce talking about the Kachemak Bay Shorebird Festival. It's coming up on May 9th, and very much appreciate you being with us.
My pleasure, Charles. Thank you, and thank you, Nils.
Yeah, good hearing you, Monty.
All right.
All right. Thank you.
We're going to be back in the second half of the show to talk more about birding and bird festivals that are coming up this spring. But now it's time for the Outdoor Explorer calendar. On Thursday, April 25th, REI in Anchorage will host a free class on birding basics. If you've ever been interested in birding but didn't know how to get started, this class is for you. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and Audubon Alaska will teach you basic birding how-tos, where to look for birds, and about birding gear from binoculars to new birding apps. Space is limited, so reserve your spot online or by calling REI in Anchorage. Get outside and watch some bush pilot competitions at the annual May Day Fly-In, Friday, May 10th through Sunday, May 12th in Valdez. I know this is a huge event for folks who are interested in aviation. Look forward to short takeoff and short landing competitions, as well as helicopter stunts and skydiving. For more info on the May Day Fly-In, go to maydayflyin.com. I don't think I've ever seen a helicopter stunt. That sounds kind of scary. And finally, fish from your rowboats or kayaks in the Seldovia Human-Powered Fishing Derby on Saturday, May 25th through Sunday, May 26th. Rentals are available. The weigh-in will be held Saturday at 6 p.m. and Sunday at 4 p.m. For more information, go to seldovia.com. And we have links to all these events on our site at alaskapublic.org. And last but certainly not least, Slush Cup is this weekend at Alyeska Resort in Girdwood. To tell us more about Slush Cup, not so easy to say, and other events happening at Alyeska Spring Carnival this weekend, we have us by phone, Brian Burnett from Alyeska Resort. Hi, Brian.
Hey, Charles. Good afternoon. It is a glorious spring day down here in Girdwood, and we're looking forward to another few days of bright blue.
Oh, it must be amazing skiing with all this sunshine and plenty of snow left on the mountain, probably for a long while yet.
Yeah, it's pretty spectacular. The cooler temperatures this week have left a great snowpack on the mountain.
So, Slush Cup, I have this mental image of people trying to ski across a pool of water, and I know there's a lot more to it, but that's sort of the signature event, and I've always been curious about how the heck you do that. Have you ever done it, Brian?
You know, it's Spring Carnival has the Slush Cup in it, and absolutely, I think every kid from Girdwood has gone across the Slush Cup once or twice in their career.
And did you make it all the way across?
I have made it all the way across, and I have also flailed before, that's for sure.
So what's the secret?
The secret is cunning. That's the secret.
Oh, you're not going to give it away. Okay.
Exactly. We want to make the youngsters work for a couple of dunks before they learn how to make it across.
I get it. Yeah, we got to keep our the old and cunning have to keep our small advantage in sports, right?
Exactly. So basically what you have to do is show up with a killer costume Friday night at the Sitzmark, like from 6 to 9 o'clock. We're doing costume judging. You have to have a costume to be in. We select 50 people to try and make it across the pond. 25 people get selected on Friday night in the costume competition, and then the other 25 people are selected on Saturday starting at noon before we head into the Slush Cup, which starts at 4 o'clock.
I see. So it's the quality of your costume which determines if you're going to get the opportunity to try to ski across the water.
Absolutely, yeah. You need to come out and show us your plumage, and we're looking for that freak flag to be flying. The costumes definitely have to be family-friendly.
All right, so you do have to wear something.
You do have to, yes.
All right, and what else is happening with the Spring Carnival?
So Spring Carnival on Saturday, of course, is we have vendors all around the base area, and then we have a what we like to call the Idiot Swim, which is a lot of people that don't make it into the Slush Cup event themselves. We give them a chance just to get wet and cold and let them swim across. So Idiot Swim at 3:30. 4 o'clock is when the Slush Cup event starts, and we generally wrap that up right at about 6 o'clock, and the winner's going to get a free Alyeska pass for next season.
Whoa, that's a big prize.
Exactly. You know, and then we go into concerts at the Sitzmark. We got Jerry Joseph and the Jack Mormons playing. And then Sunday, we kind of go into a little more some down-home stuff here at Alyeska, a little lower key. We have a dummy downhill. We've got kids from some of our departments, and some of the kids from the local schools make dummies to send off a big jump and crash it into an embankment.
That sounds like fun.
So that one's fun. And then at 2 o'clock, we have the extra tough tug of war, which is a tug of war over a pond. And basically the last dry team wins a pair of extra toughs for everybody on the team.
Oh, excellent prize. Wow.
Yeah. It is. It's a super fun event, and it costs there's no charge to enter that or the dummy event. And
it's just basically show up. Just show up and do it?
Yep, just show up with four other really tough friends, and that's what it takes. And we also have a junior division.
Great. So it sounds like a great weekend to go to Alyeska, especially if the weather's like it is right now, which I guess the forecast is good. One thing I wanted to ask you before I let you go, Brian, is I think I saw something in the newspaper about Chair 6 being rehabilitated or rebuilt, and the mountain closing a little earlier this year because of that. Can you give us the brief version of what's happening with that?
Yeah, the last day of skiing is going to be on Sunday, April 28th, the last day of our normal season. And then in order to accomplish the work that we need to, we are going to be closed. That's the closing of operations. And we start dismantling and planning to rebuild Chair 6 over this summer. So we're going to have a shiny, clean, brand-new high-speed quad for next winter.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for being with us, Brian Burnett, the manager at the mountain down in Girdwood at the Alyeska Resort. Thanks for being on the show with us.
You betcha, Charles. Cheers.
Okay, thanks a lot. So you're listening to Outdoor Explorer on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Charles Wolforth. You know, KSKA is member-supported radio. KSKA's spring membership drive is this week. Programming relies on your financial support. Rachel Martin, host of NPR's Sunday Weekend Edition, tells us more.
Hi, this is Rachel Martin, host of NPR's Weekend Edition Sundays on KSKA, where you can find The Puzzler with Will Shortz, Good Company on the ride home from work, with All Things Considered and Alaska News Nightly, and Outdoor Explorer Thursdays. KSKA and NPR exist for you. And thanks to your financial support, you're able to enjoy another day with public radio. Please make your pledge at alaskapublic.org. You spend your time with KSKA. Decide then that KSKA is worthy of your financial support. Pledge online at alaskapublic.org. KSKA, life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer from KSKA Anchorage. The program repeats tonight at 7 p.m. on FM 91.1. If you're listening in the evening, it is a recorded rebroadcast and will not be taking phone calls. Connect with Outdoor Explorer anytime, download podcasts, and see what's coming up on future programs at alaskapublic.org.
It's Outdoor Explorer, and we are talking about birding today. Shorebird festivals that are taking place in Homer and in Cordova in the coming weeks. In the studio with me today is Nils Warnock, who's Executive Director of Audubon Alaska. And on the phone is Milo Burcham from the Prince William Sound Audubon Society. Thanks for being with us, Milo.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me.
I'm glad your plane landed in time for you to be with us. And we welcome listeners who want to weigh in or have comments. I'd especially be interested in, if you've been to either of these festivals, what was it like? You know, would you recommend that your friends and neighbors give it a try? If you'd like to be on the air with us, it's 550-8433, 550-8433, outside Anchorage, 1-888-353-5752. And on Facebook, it's Outdoor Explorer. Milo, the Copper River Delta Shorebird Festival is coming up, and it sounds a little bit different from the Homer Festival in that Cordova's a smaller town, and it's maybe a more intimate festival. It comes a week earlier, May 2nd through 5th. And my memory of many great trips to Cordova is it's like the friendliest town on earth, and you kind of go and get adopted into the town. And so I'm curious, can you just give us an overview of what the festival is all about and how you welcome birders to town?
Yeah, I can. And first of all, I think your impression of Cordova is right. I think it's a small, friendly town, and people that show up there just find people waving at them and just feel like they're a little bit of part of town while they're visiting. Our festival is taking place May 2nd through 5th. The weekend of the Saturday and Sunday, the 4th and 5th, is the main part of the festival. And the biggest thing about it is it's just about birds. We don't have any other activities going on. We try to focus our attention on the shorebirds, and we're one of the best places to witness, you know, large migration stopover. The one way I have to put it into perspective is I've got to entertain some of our speakers over the past years, Kevin Carlson and Arthur Morris and Scott Weidensall. These are authors and photographers and biologists that have traveled, you know, to shorebird migration stopovers all over the world. And when I've had them here in Cordova, I've just been impressed by their reactions at the number of birds. We have 4 to 6 million shorebirds that stop over on the Copper River Delta en route to their breeding grounds, and the site is second to nothing. It's truly impressive when you hit it just right.
Yeah, and so how do you sort of help people who haven't been to Cordova get out to the right spots where they can see them? Because I know it's a Copper River Delta is a huge area.
It's a huge area, but actually only a small part of it's accessible, and we have a lot of activities that introduce people to the shorebirds. First of all, we have a keynote presentation Friday night, and it's going to be Mr. White Keys, Anchorage's own, giving a presentation about everything you want to know about birds and less. This is his take on birding in Alaska. And then we have a opening presentation by Greg Butcher of the Fish and Wildlife or U.S. Forest Service International Programs talking about Alaska's southern connections. First thing Friday morning, there's a bird walk around town to start people birding, and all you have to do is meet downtown and go on a walk, you know, just around town, some of the waterfront to see some Cordova birds. There'll be a field trip, actually, that I lead out to Alleghanic Slough, which is a good place to see shorebirds and other waterfowl. There are regular bus trips from downtown Cordova out to Hartney Bay, which is the main viewing area to see shorebirds. And anyway, we bend over backwards to get people to all these events and especially out to the flats at Hartney Bay to see the shorebirds. And we recommend people try to get there at high tide. That's the time that the shorebirds are concentrated. On Saturday, that's around 10 a.m., and on Sunday, that's 11 o'clock a.m. To see the most birds.
Okay. And some of Milo's photos are on our website at alaskapublic.org, and they show these enormous groups of birds and people watching them. They're quite extraordinary that there could be that many birds in one place. And we've also had a listener who's contributed some photos on our Facebook page, and I would invite folks to take a look at that at Outdoor Explorer. Rebecca posted some great pictures. And there's also a video there of red poles at a bird feeder in Anchorage, which is really neat. It's a, you know, you can just see the birds from very, very close up, and a really nice video by a former guest we had on the show. So all that is available for you. And of course, we welcome your comments on that Facebook page as well. Nils Warnock, you're the you're sort of our resident shorebird expert, having been well, I guess you're still a scientist, but you worked as a scientist before becoming director of Audubon Alaska. What makes the Copper River Delta such an exceptional place? I mean, I've heard it called one of the most productive wetlands in the world, and with many, many different species, not only shorebirds. Why is it so important, and what makes it so good for birding?
Well, when you get that many birds in one place, you know that there's a lot of food there. Mm-hmm. So I think that the bottom line is that the copper with the rivers coming out, a lot of nutrients coming down and flowing out into these extensive, shallow, mudflat areas, it gives a lot of food and a lot of habitat for these birds to stop at. And that's what they're looking for. They're looking for a lot of food that they can get in a short amount of time. So... Yeah.
Are most of the shorebirds that are coming through looking for the same kind of food resources in terms of, you mentioned these small clams and isopods and little crustaceans and stuff?
Yeah. Yeah, I would say the majority of those birds are going after similar kinds. I mean, there's differences among species. Things like red knots tend to be real specialists on small clams. But they'll go after different things. The surf birds and... turnstones, black turnstones. There used to be a big herring spawn on Montague Island. Milo's taken some terrific pictures of that, and they'll come and they'll eat the roe of the herring. That's been a really big place for especially surf birds and black turnstones. One of the highest concentrations in the world of those species, they're not seeing the same numbers of herring spawning there, so...
Right, ever since the Exxon Valdez oil spill, basically.
Yeah. That's right, yeah. So...
So, Milo, I think Hartney Bay is one of the top spots to go, right? And that's not very far from town.
Correct? I didn't catch that. Could you say that again?
Hartney Bay is one of the top spots to go and look at the shorebirds?
It is one of the top spots. Not that there's not... more, the Copper River Delta is vast. You know, the habitat that attracts these birds is vast, but also difficult to access without specialized craft like airboats because it's so vast and shallow. But Hartney Bay is a really productive little piece of the Copper River Delta that is accessible by road, the Whiteshed Road, about 5 miles from downtown Cordova. And I think of it as sort of a spillover spot. When the numbers on the Delta are high, they really stack into Hartney Bay. And as much as we like bluebird weather, if it gets a little stormy out, I think it's one of the places they come for shelter. And, tens of thousands, if not 100,000 birds at peak of migration can stack up in that one small bay.
Wow. And so there, do you take the birders out there in vans or something? Because I know there aren't very many rental cars available in Cordova.
Right. There'll be either a van or a bus that's running periodically between downtown and Harney Bay to take people out to the flats. And there'll be some people standing by to act as guides and information to, so that people know what they're looking at, help them identify shorebirds and point out the bigger flocks and just kind of act as interpreters there.
Mm-hmm. What we were saying earlier about how friendly Cordova is very true, and I remember my first visit there, just being befriended by a guy with a pickup truck who just sort of drove me around and drove me out to look at trumpeter swans and just like, and every time I've gone, it's been like that. I actually took a week-long vacation there with my family, and we weren't bored for a minute. We had all these fantastic outdoor experiences, and then the kids were blown away because they felt like they were in a movie set. They had never seen a small town with nothing but these little mom-and-pop businesses, and that they could just walk around safely and, and be kids. And it really is something like a throwback to another time. So I really recommend people going down there. I love Homer, too, but Cordova is also a really special place. I guess, Milo, what's the purpose of the festival? I mean, how do you is it focused on conservation? Is it focused on bringing some needed visitor dollars into the community, or why do you get involved in it?
Well, both of those are very good reasons why the festival takes place. Sure, we like to bring people to Cordova at a time of year when we don't have very many visitors. It's a quiet time. The fishing season hasn't quite started yet. But the focus of the festival is shorebird conservation and to kind of impress upon people the importance of the Copper River Delta as a stopover habitat for 4 to 6 million birds that winter in faraway places like the South Pacific, the coasts of South America, Central America, anyway, from basically all over the world that fly through that point on their way to other locations. And anyway, we really try to impress upon people the importance of conservation of tidal flats and shorebird habitat in general.
Now, I saw something in the news about one of the major bridges going down on the Copper River Highway. That highway is one of the just premier resources for getting into the outdoors in all of Alaska. You can get out to the Childs Glacier and get out to McKinley Lake and all these wonderful canoeing areas. Is that the bridge still out, and how much does it cut off? In other words, how far out into the Delta can you get without the bridge?
Yeah, the bridge is still out, and it's still a bit of a question mark when it'll be repaired. We're really hoping it does because our town loves access to Childs Glacier in the summertime. 36-mile marker is where the bridge is out. The road typically goes 52 miles, so we're losing just a few miles of road out towards the end. But that being said, it really has no bearing on visitors during the Shorebird Festival because snow stops the road well before you would ever get to that bridge. Much beyond 25 mile, I think there's large snow drifts that would keep people from getting any further.
Yeah.
So the focus in early May for visitors is getting to the Copper River Delta to see waterfowl and shorebirds in general, and of course Harney Bay to see the the large numbers of shorebirds.
Yeah. Does anybody bring skis? I just was thinking, they're probably the skiing's still pretty good.
The skiing is still great. We have great. Our ski hill is closed for the season. It just closed with a final party and picnic last weekend. But backcountry opportunities are fantastic. And just yesterday, a storm ended with 12 inches of snow in Cordova. So
Alaska is so great, that you like ski season and spring birding season, getting out on the water all coincide, I know some people are sick of snow, but I'm still enjoying the skiing very much.
Many in Cordova are still too.
Yeah, great. Well, you better like snow if you live in Cordova, right?
Or rain.
Yeah, right. Well, you wouldn't get a rainforest if you didn't have rain, so don't complain. We've touched just sort of tangentially on conservation issues. And I'm curious about the health of these shorebird populations and any threats that exist, and if there's any issues that Alaskans should be concerned about in terms of the the health of these populations?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. We do know, like our most abundant shorebird here, the western sandpiper, based on counts at home or at Kachemak Bay, they've declined quite a bit there in recent years, in probably the last 20 years. We have historic counts from Kachemak up in 100,000 birds, and nowadays it's closer to 10, 15,000 western sandpipers. So, and if we look, we don't have a really good monitoring system along the west coast for shorebirds, but if we look at other sites, western sandpipers have been declining, as well as Dunlin, some of our smaller shorebirds, and we're not entirely sure why. It may be there's redistribution of birds going on with our climate changing. We think that for species like Dunlin, they're starting to winter farther north than they ever did. But we're trying to figure that out. But it does look like some of these smaller birds are having troubles. And a lot of that probably has to do with habitat loss in the lower 48s and beyond. I mean, there are places that are really getting hammered. Our world mm-hmm. is getting bigger and bigger. There's a lot of people here, and people like to live in the same areas that these birds like to use, on the coast and estuaries. So in general, the world's getting to be a smaller place for these species.
But, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there's two important ones to touch on there. But in the terms of the climate change issue, I know that there's been a trend over the last 20 or 30 years of springtime getting earlier. You wouldn't really notice it this year, but one year doesn't break the trend. And you talked earlier in the show about the very narrow window that these birds need to hit so that they can get through while there's still food. Winter has backed off, but before it's too late for them to be laying their eggs. Is that window get narrowed or get messed up by the changing climate?
Yeah, and that's a hot topic right now. Is this what they're talking about? Is, well, earlier I said these birds, they come up and they show up to the tundra, and the hatch of their young, so that when the eggs hatch, the hatch is really tightly linked to when all the insects come out, the peak hatch of the insects. And what we're seeing is, we're starting to see a disconnect, and we're decoupling that. And the question is, and we don't really know, whether shorebirds can respond to that decoupling of the timing. Hmm. And for some species, there's data that shows that they're not doing very well that way, and others seem to be tracking the change in the environment. But it's a big question mark. The other one is for, like, the super long distance migrants I talked about, the bar-tailed godwit. Well, they rely on these global wind patterns that are really predictable. So in the fall, these birds will stack up on the Alaska Peninsula, just like our Dunlin, for instance, and they'll leave on these big low systems on the tail ends and use those winds to migrate big distances. And climate change is impacting all of those systems in ways that we don't really understand yet. We're mm-hmm. seeing that by our really variable weather that people are noticing mm-hmm. all over the place.
Is the date of the migration changing over a long time period, or do you have good enough records to look at that?
Definitely for a lot of species, we're seeing earlier arrivals. But.
And you mentioned habitat. I would guess that the Alaska habitat is probably pretty unchanged, but in other places you're seeing more residential development on shorelines, and that's affecting habitat?
Oh, yeah. Well, California over the last 200 years filled in about 98% of its wetlands. Mm-hmm. But we're seeing some really unprecedented habitat loss in other places. The Yellow Sea in China is one of my pet, I think it's probably the biggest conservation crisis in the world right now. Yellow Sea is a very shallow sea. It's bordered by China, North and South Korea. And all our bar-tailed godwits stop at the Yellow Sea in the spring. When they migrate northward, they leave New Zealand, Australia. They go nonstop up to the Yellow Sea and spend a month there. Well, they're filling the mudflats in. They're basically building dikes and pumping mud into the diked in areas, and then they build upon that. But the scale is phenomenal. They're they filled in the last 5 years an area bigger than all of Rhode Island.
Wow.
And so we're seeing huge amounts of habitat loss at a very rapid scale and in a time scale that is just, you know,
no way to adapt.
Amazing.
Yeah. And so then we just experience that as less birds getting here. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we've got a few minutes left here on Outdoor Explorer. We're talking about birding and the bird festivals happening May 9th in Homer and May 2nd in Cordova. And I've been talking with Nils Warnock, who's executive director of Audubon Alaska. And on the line with me is Milo Burcham, who's with the Prince William Sound Audubon Society, and whose just spectacular photos we have on our Facebook page, Outdoor Explorer, and at alaskapublic.org. Milo, I wanted to ask you about photography, because taking a good picture obviously is a big part of birding. And I don't know, there's something about that's your trophy, right, is the picture that you bring back. And I know that there must be a lot of skill involved, because most of us, when we try to take pictures of wildlife, we end up with sort of, at best, like a brown dot in the middle of a really big area. And yet your pictures are extraordinary. What are some tips you can give to amateur photographers to take better pictures of birds?
I guess there's no one secret I could give somebody right now, except for a lot of photographers say F11 and be there. Just be there and spend time and take a lot of pictures and edit carefully. But I can make a plug. One of our activities this festival is Michael Quinton is giving a photography workshop. Michael Quinton is a photographer. He actually lives in Slana. And he's done feature stories for National Geographic. He's done a feature story on great gray owls and ravens, and there's some other species he's done incredible work on. Someone could learn a lot by attending his workshop just by rubbing shoulders with somebody like that. A real modest guy, and I think photographers, if they come to Cordova for the festival, would have a lot of fun.
Cool.
And learn a lot.
And probably learn tips from the other birders, too. And to come, you just need to get on the website and register. And is there a fee?
Yes, there is. The Cordova Chamber website is www.cordovachamber.com. There's also a Facebook page. And you can register for $65. It's $30 extra for the banquet. And that $65, you know, covers everything, including the transportation to the flats. I wanted to
Great.
Say, Alaska Airlines, you can get to Cordova by ferry, go to the Alaska Marine Highway website, and then there's some talk that Alaska Airlines might have a special. Check the festival website or the Facebook page for details on that. It hasn't been announced yet, but there might be a special.
Yeah, and we have that link on our website as well. And
Great.
There are not too many rooms in Cordova. I guess it's probably be a good time to start making your reservations.
Yeah, that certainly couldn't hurt.
Mm-hmm. We have that link to the Copper River Shorebird Festival on our site, and so people can find it that way. And these pictures that we've been talking about on the Facebook page, and I'd like to invite listeners to check in on that Facebook page, because we're interested in your thoughts on our show today and future shows that we're going to be doing, and questions that you might submit and provide. So check it out. It's Outdoor Explorer on Facebook. Milo, you mentioned that you have a talk on from a photographer and other talks and buses. And is this like a highlight of your year coming up?
Yeah, it is on a lot of levels. First of all, just personally, I just can't wait to see the shorebirds and to photograph them when I get the opportunity. But it's great to see great presentations from worldwide authorities on birds or the entertainment of Mr. White Keys. It's just something I look forward to all year. And on that note, some shorebirds have started to arrive. Yesterday, I saw 5 greater yellowlegs on Alleghanic Slough, which are migrants that are just coming back. And today, I had a report of 2 Wilson snipe, and also saw not a shorebird, but a Thompson solitaire.
Excellent. Excellent ending there. All right. Well, thanks to Milo Burcham. He's with the Prince William Sound Audubon Society. Niels Warnock was here with me, Executive Director of Audubon Alaska. And earlier we heard from Monty Davis of the Homer Chamber of Commerce and Brian Burnett from the Alaska Resort down in Girdwood. Next week on Outdoor Explorer, I'll be out of town. Annie Fite will be hosting, talking about the start of the Denali climbing season. Thanks for joining us today on Outdoor Explorer. Kristen Spack is our producer. Audio engineer is Dave Waldron. I'm Charles Wolforth. Happy trails.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal the Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to alaskapublic.org.